The third verse begins with a proper name, a name of someone who's like us. In Upanishadic description, a householder. Anyone who lives like we live in this world is a householder. If you're not a householder, then you're a sannyasin. Saunaka, the great householder, duly approached Enguerras and asked, "Through what being known, venerable sir, does all this become known?" In other words, he's asking a strategic, methodological question. How can I have knowledge, the specific kind of knowledge which will allow me to learn all knowledge? In other words, I want the key to the universe. I know there's a key. And the key is a certain kind of technical knowledge. It's a technique knowledge that if I have that, I will be able to continue. It's like having magic ring and you have only one wish, and the wish that you give is that you wish to have an infinite number of wishes. Voila, all you need is one wish with that kind of cleverness, you see. So on the sage level, the cleverness is not to look for answers, but to look for the answer which allows you to understand whatever answer you would need. But notice that this raises it to a transcendental level, from the phenomenal to the noumenal level. You're asking a structural question. You're asking for a structural kind of knowledge. So the householder right here is showing that he's not just a householder, but he's on the verge of transcending that whole worldly quality. He's right on the edge. He's on the interface between this world and the next, is the colloquial way to put it. So that the teacher of the Mundaka Upanishad is saying, this teaching, which comes down from God, the last stage where it comes to you is from a householder of this quality who's on the interface. So that you can only hear this Upanishad if you get yourself to the next step right next to that interface. So in a strategic way, the teacher in the Mundaka Upanishad is characterizing what you need to do, what posture of attention you need to engender in order to be able to hear the beginning, the thread. The Sanskrit word for thread is sutra, the beginning of this thread of understanding. And of course, the ultimate strategic understanding is that the thread is like one of those optical fibers. It's completely transparent all the way through. There's no resistance whatsoever. So that when you begin, you think that you're trying to follow the sutra by trying to follow the logical connection. And only when you get experienced at this do you stop trying to feel the fine hair-like qualities of the distinctions, and you realize that you can follow it without using your hands at all. And that's the beginning of grace right there, when you stop trying to reach for it and you realize you don't have to reach for it. It's given to you. It's a gift. There's no subtlety at all. It's completely apparent. Well, what's happened is that you have changed. You've attuned yourself to the fineness and the exactness of reality, and you've lost the ignorant skittishness of the world. Because in terms of the world, this is so fine, so refined, that you really have to be careful, because it's like a little spider web. You're going to lose it. You can't see it. You look for glints here and there. And as long as you do that, you're still in this world. But when you follow it without fearing to lose it, then you've already gone through and are in the interface, in that grace. So the Mundaka Upanishad, the teacher, who is very, very, very good, says it this way. Saunaka, the great householder, duly approached Angiras and asked, through what being known, venerable sir, does all this become known? To him, he said, two kinds of knowledge are to be known, as indeed the knowers of Brahman declare, the higher as well as the lower. So he starts him off in that way. Of these, the lower is the Rig Veda, the Yajur Veda, the Sama Veda, the Atharva Veda. Phonetics, ritual, grammar, etymology, metrics, astrology. These are the qualities of the lower knowledge. This is how you begin holding on to the thread. And the higher is that by which the undecaying is apprehended. That which is ungraspable, without family, without caste, without sight or hearing, without hands or feet, eternal, all-pervading, omnipresent, exceedingly subtle. That is the undecay, which the wise perceive as the source of things. As a spider sends forth and draws in its thread, as herbs grow on the earth, as hair grows on the head, and the body of a living person, so from the imperishable arises here this universe. Now pause for a second, because you need to remind yourself of what's happening. It seemed to you that I was just talking colloquially and spontaneously and just giving examples and pulling them out of the hat and so forth. And yet, all of the examples and the seeming spontaneous metaphors that I use all of a sudden coalesce and become the actual text of Mundaka Upanishad. This is the way which wisdom teaching was conducted in ancient times. When it's first occurring, it doesn't seem like there's anything other than just the usual happening. Because what distinguishes it is not a worldly distinctiveness at all. So if you're looking for something powerful, or something catchy, or something clever, or something deep, you'll miss it completely. Because those are all worldly qualities, and they're extraneous to higher wisdom. They're just extraneous. They mean nothing. I mean, Dharma doesn't care if you're wearing spats or not. So what? So you've got 8,000 hours of analysis? Far out. Did you squash a bug today? It's like that, you see. As a spider sends forth and draws in its thread, as herbs grow on the earth, as hair grows on the head and on the body of a living person, so from the imperishable arises here the universe. So that the object of investigation for science, this universe in all of its phenomenal aspect, is a mysterious occurrence in its actuality. And a true science is able to see it in its exactness to the point of the mysterious occurring quite exactly. So that our idea of science as being kind of like a 19th century stereotype, that science means putting specimens in little urine bottles and putting them on shelves with old manila labels and old brown fading ink words. That's not it at all. Science is exactly what is spiritual. Exactly what is spiritual. But it has to shave to a certain depth, to a certain level, before you realize that that's exactly what you've been doing. You have to not only split the atom, but you have to split the neutron, and you have to split the quark structure, and then you start to come out, as modern physics has, with words like strangeness and beauty to describe qualities that really we're not sure where they are or what they are, but we know that they are, and that on some fundamental level, this is true. It's true of everything. So that towards the end of the 20th century now, we've come in a Mundaka Upanishad way far enough along in science to understand finally what it is that we're doing. We're shaving ignorance away from ourselves on colossal world scale. Let's take a break. We're trying to realize that in making a shift from history to science, is a very arcane procedure. And the reason why we've had such terrible difficulties the last 200 years is that we haven't been able to do this very adequately. There have been individuals who can do this, but there are no societies who have been able to do this. The world as a whole has not been able to do this. So that we're hung up, as it were. We're not able to come into being in a way which is commensurate with where we are in our life path as a species. The first two people who were capable of this were Sir Isaac Newton and Leibniz. They're the first ones to master the kind of mathematical language that was required, differential and integral calculus, to allow for consciousness to precipitate itself out of the historical transformational medium into the spiritual self of science. And both Newton and Leibniz were able to do that in and of themselves, but were both unable to pass that on to anyone else. One of the great tragedies of history. The effect that Newton had in the English language was to introduce a note that eventually transformed poetry in the English language. Newton's consciousness introduced a tone that in a very short time, in one generation, produced William Blake and Shelley. And the difference between poets like Keats and Shelley and Blake and those English poets that came before them is astronomical. We don't even read those. We don't even know the names of those poets anymore. We don't care. And there's a direct line from Blake and Shelley straight through to Yeats, for instance, in our own time. From William Blake and Shelley to Yeats is a constant struggle of consciousness to try and come out of history into a scientia, into a knowing. And there was no lack of ability to discern patterns. Because at the end of that sequence of poets, Yeats had such a power of resolution, of drawing patterns out of language, that he could take his wife's automatic writing, suitcases full of it, and pull out the metaphysical document known as a vision, which was published at the end of his life, which has the 28-phase lunar cycle complete. And he pulled this classic hermetic diagrammatic doctrine out of his wife's automatic writing. So it wasn't a lack of ability. Man is ready. Human beings are ready. Individuals are ready by the tens of millions. But it's a structural problem and not a problem in content. Even though you have the ability, does not guarantee that you can still do it. You can be mature and ready and still not have done it. I don't know how to make it more graphic than to say you can enter pubescence and still not be active. And if that goes on for some time, it has its effects. Pardon me for the gender slur, but I need to get this through. There's a kind of an old maidish kind of a quality that begins to come into the personality. And by 1990, the human personality is beginning to really suffer from this. And of course, the image base that comes up from this, out of the body, is the impulse to do something, not to stay where you are, but to get out, to go any place, but don't stay where you are. And of course, that's exactly the right message, but it's exactly the wrong meaning. It isn't to get out and go someplace else, it's to get up and go within. It's not in the Bahamas. It's not in the Himalayas. You have the same problems if you go there. Except that it seems like you've done something. And this fascination with surrogateness is just incredible. It's a, pardon me, it's a kind of a masturbation. It isn't doing what you really need to do. You need to go within. But that process of going within cannot be done through thought. Thought is one aspect of what can go in, but thought cannot go in. Its whole nature, remember, is a radiance from the self. And the best that thought can do is trace itself back into the inscrutable. The best you can come up with is a very clear, precise, exact idea that it's the origins of thought are inscrutable to thought. And that's the right answer. That's A plus time. That is the answer. So that the struggle with trying to power thought in order to push it deeper is fool's game. That's not it at all. The meaning is that don't use the thinking function to try and go deeper. It goes as deep as it can, and that's it. It's a quality of wholeness, as the colloquial phrase is. One can only go within in a whole way. Only wholes can see wholes. There's a double pun there. Sorry for the entendre, but it's in the language. Only opennesses can see opennesses. And when they do, they don't see anything. Openness occurs. It's the famous saying from Huang Po, when two Zen masters meet each other, it's just wind. Just a fresh wind. That's all. So Han Shan doesn't ever say that he's talking to someone. He just says, There's moonlight on the cold rocks, and it's on the pines, and that's all that's here. And there might be five or six people, but it's just the moonlight on the rocks and the trees. It's just cold mountain in the evening. Because the transparency of the human has been achieved. And what the deep self radiates now is just pure, clear spirit. That is scientific. In other words, that can be known to an exactness which is astonishing, to any degree of specificity that you want. You write out the specificity. You make up the spec sheet, what you would consider demonstrable, certain evidence, and present it to yourself, and you can meet every single requirement. It's not ambiguous. It's not a guessing game. It's not a hope syndrome at all. The original Hellenistic Jewish phrase, which translates as good news, is quite accurate. It's good news. Aha, there it is. The transformation from mankind out of historical, ideational, thought-toned consciousness into science is something that has just never been achieved. Our species on this planet has never achieved it. Individuals have. No society ever has. Now, in East Asia, the Chinese struggled with this in the Sung Dynasty, and they failed. And the breakdown, the ensuing breakdown of Sung civilization led directly to the Mongols coming in and taking over China and East Asia. The Sung was the highest development in Chinese history. It's when Chinese science was fantastic. It was pristine. The Taoists had developed calculus in the monastic retreats as early as the 9th century, the 800s. They developed printing about the same time. The Diamond Sutra is printed about 880 AD. That incredible facility available to disseminate the language of science, higher mathematics, to the population and effect a change, to take East Asian Chinese civilization out of history into science. And they failed. They couldn't do it. And the resulting atrophy laid them open to the incursion of the Mongols, the Yuan Dynasty, Genghis Khan. The same condition obtains now in all of those civilizations, primarily the European, by the late 20th century. If there isn't a scientific, achievable civilization in one more generation, it won't happen for a very, very long time. A couple hundred years, 300-400 years. It won't happen. And there'll be a resulting atrophy. You can see it already in the kinds of apocalyptic images that come out of the human psyche. So it's a time of great promise and great jeopardy. It's just like in a fairy tale. The worst and the best occur exactly together at the end. What end? At the time when a new form precipitates out of the fertile matrix. And if the new form doesn't come out, the matrix has to give birth, and so it gives birth in a retroactive way, and one goes back. One goes back what? One goes back to, in this case, instead of the achievement of the spirit in a scientific civilization, one goes back to the person in a kind of a individualistic kind of society. And you tend then, the way that this happens in world civilization, you tend to have great conquerors, and that plays itself down to feudal lords. So that the 21st century would be a time of enormous demagogues, and the 22nd century would be a time of feudal hierarchies, of corporate kingdoms, that you're lucky if you're a member of one and you're unlucky if you're not a member of any. The handwriting is on the wall. Those are the patterns that have occurred in the past. And they're like deep ruts. They're guaranteed. They're in place. They're, if we do nothing, they'll happen. That's what will happen. But we always have the capacity to change the name of the game, change the rules, by introducing our creative achievement and changing the mix. And we can do that. But the one missing ingredient is a population of people, not just scattered individuals who can do this, but a population of people who have confidence that not only can they do this as individuals, but they can pool their efforts together as communities. You need whole, stable communities of human beings who can be spiritually scientific. And that's not happening. And none of the communities that are here are going to do it. Not the Scientologists, not the Mormons, not the Buddhists, not anybody. There isn't anybody. None of those groups are founded in such a way as to really affect the change, as to precipitate out of solution the spirit. So we live in a time where everything, every form is dissolving. Every form that man has made is dissolving. Another 5 or 6 years and everyone will be able to notice it. Everything that you will look at will be dissolving, will be fading. It's not apocalyptic so much like Max Ernst's paintings of Europe after the rain. That's kind of melodramatic. But no forms of human endeavor will really work right. In another 10 years, it'll just be it'll be catastrophic in that kind of a way, because it coincides with the millennium. It'll seem like this is really a curse. What is the curse? Nothing that man does works. It's just like in the first century of the Common Era, the old classic oracles didn't work anymore. You could go to Delphi, and the oracle didn't work anymore. It worked for thousands of years. How can an oracle not work? Well, the colloquial conclusion was that the old gods are dead. That's the colloquial conclusion that will be drawn also another 10 years. The conviction of atheism in its worst kind of a form. Nihilism. And of course, what is legitimate in face of nihilism is only kind of is like the poignancy of the punk rocker's bitterness is the only value that you can really get behind that. Well, God damn it all. Is about the only thing that you can really get behind. That carries one regressively all the way back to a kind of a ritual level. And man with this kind of power on a ritual level it would be terrifying. The world would be filled with wild beasts haunted by their own incompetence. That would not be a world that you would like to be in. So there's a lot at stake. But fortunately, the way universal law is, even if one person does it right, it's done. So even though there's a lot at stake, take heart, take heart. In our transition from history to science, we're using the Mundaka Upanishad as an object text to focus our attention on exactly what is required. The sage says, that which is ungraspable, without family, without caste, without sight or hearing, without hands or feet, eternal, all-pervading, omnipresent, exceedingly subtle, that is the undecaying which the wise perceive as the source of beings. As a spider sends forth and draws in its thread, as herbs grow on the earth, as hair grows on the head and on the body of a living person, so from the imperishable rises this universe. By contemplative power, Brahman expands, radiates out as a contemplative energy. It's a sine wave, which is analog, neurological in form. And that sine wave generates the trigonometric universe that we experience as phenomena. From that, food is produced. From food, life is produced. From life, mind is produced. From mind, the real is produced. Five elements. By contemplative power, Brahman, food, life, mind, real. The five elements. And from those five, working the worlds. And thence, because of the worlds, the rituals. Through the rituals, with comprehension, immortality. He who is all-knowing and all-wise, whose austerity consists of knowledge, from him are born this Brahma, name, shape, and food. So you can see how the Mundaka begins. Now watch how the development goes. The phrase that they're going to center on is Tad etat satyam. Now, satya is the normal word for truth. Like in truth, holding is satyagraha, satya. But in the Mundaka Upanishad, because it's concerned with differentiation by shaving, satyam is split into its syllables, and when it doesn't go into two syllables, but goes into three. You would think it would be sat-yam, but it's sat-yam. So that truth is triadic, not bifocal. Truth is not a polarity. Truth is always triadic. So a spiritually informed language always mirrors this. Language is a mirror of the real. And the phrase is tad etat satyam, satyam. And the section in Radhakrishnan's version here is entitled Ceremonial Religion. In other words, the first part of the Upanishad is about nature in terms of the real. And the second part is about ritual. The essence of what comes next is ritual. And the beginning words, tad or tat etat satyam, means this is that truth. So that truth has a that-ness when you pronounce it satyam. So it becomes a mantra. If you say satyam, then it's a designatory noun, truth. If you say satyam, there's an experiential thusness. Tad e tat satyam. This is that truth. It's reflective back. The works which the sages saw in the hymns are variously spread forth in the three Vedas. Perform them constantly, ye lovers of truth. This is your path to the world of good deeds. When the flame which moves after the fire has been kindled, then one should throw with faith his oblations between the two portions of melted butter. What does one throw? All right, you're putting in the ghee, the butter. And as it melts, there's the form of the ghee unmelted and the form of the ghee melted. And in between them is a shrinking interface of solid and liquid. And one throws one's faith as a third element in the interface between solid and liquid. How does one throw one's faith in there? By word. Satya. The language carries you into that. And what was phenomenally a polarity becomes a triad and spiritual. This is the acorn of what science is. The phenomenal universe is only what it is, but when you understand what it is and say so, another element comes in and it becomes spiritual. Then you do not have physis, but you have cosmos. You don't have nature just becoming, but you have nature which is. The precipitant, the alchemical precipitant, is your saying so consciously. Then the universe is not, then the universe is a universe, a universe, and not just natura. As long as nature is only nature, then light is lumen de natura, natural light. This is incandescent light. Sunlight is natural light. But when man enters in consciously and spiritually, then there's lumen de lumen, light of lights. And when one sees by light of lights, this is a cosmos, not a scattered happening, but an integral pattern which contains the consciousness because you have given it. Who is the God? You see? Who creates? By what act is there fiat lux? Tat, etat, satya. That's what the Mundaka Upanishad is saying right here. If you're following this, then you're following it. There's fire, but there's a flame in the fire. The fire can cook, but the flame in the fire can mature. So in alchemy, for instance, there's always the emphasis on the refining fire. The refining fire is the flame in the fire, not the fire. And if you don't know that, you're all the time looking for something to burn. You're all the time looking for the right fuel. The classic in Upanishads, if you read the Upanishads in their Vedic settings, always before the Upanishad begins, the Vedas always in an interface say that the aspirants come to the sage bringing fuel in their hands. Well, it means a double entendre. It's fuel because that's the basic requirement that you need to have your nourishment, to cook your food. And what gift can you bring to a teacher? He doesn't need anything. Can use fuel. minimally he's going to feed you. But also, the students must bring their own fuel. If you didn't bring your fuel, there's no way that the flame and the fire can ignite in you. You have to bring your own fuel. What is your fuel? Your aspiration. If you bring your aspiration, you can be lit. If not, it wouldn't be right, because that divine spark that would be given to you would electrocute you. And so it's withheld by compassion. If you were given to it in your ignorance, you'd be fried on the spot. You wouldn't be able to handle it. Literally. I mean literally. So now when he's talking about the flame and the fire, and you're alerted to that, he's going to talk about seven kinds of flames, seven tongues of fire. There's a black flame. A black flame. There is a terrific flame. There's a swift flame. There's a red flame. There's a smoky flame. There's a sparky flame. And seventh, there is an all-tasting flame. Notice the incredible poignancy of the ancient wisdom traditions. I mean, you get wiped clean of all the crap. And if you could follow that sevenfold typology, you can see that the seventh in there is all-inclusive. It recursively goes back through all previous six and includes them in itself, so that the all-tasting flame absorbs all the other flames and there you have your achievement. What happens after you have that kind of achievement? After you can see the flame in the fire and the sevenfoldness of that flame in the fire and its integration, then you can see for the first time that the sun has seven rays. Only then do you realize that the really big fire is the sun. Those seven flames are the rays of the sun. That's actually the life-giving. Notice how the Mundaka Upanishad takes giant steps, what we call orders of application, or orders, whole orders of amplification. We're counting by ones, then we're counting by tens, then we're counting by hundreds, then we're counting by millions. And so it's taking giant steps in leading you out of the dullness, the rut, that you normally would just be content with. I know it sounds terrible to say, but to Wisdom Eye, we're just groveling all the time. Just groveling. It's very sad. It's pitiable. So the Mundaka Upanishad is leading us by language out. Now, the classic handling of this was in one of the Buddha's great lectures. It's in the Majjhima Nikaya. And sometime when I have a chance, I'll go through a sequence of the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length sayings. And the Buddha said, think of yourself sitting in your bag of skin. And that bag of skin is sitting in this room. And this room is sitting in this house. And this house is sitting in this city. And the city is sitting on this continent. And this continent on this world. And this world around this star. And the star in a galactic spinning structure. And that in a world without end. Jumping in stages. It's a similar kind of a thing that James Joyce puts in Portrait of the Artist as a Young man where he's trying to give his complete address, such and such a street, such and such a number, Dublin, Ireland, UK, world, universe, mind of God. Because it's the flamboyance of your aspiration that counts for everything. You wonder where in all this patience flamboyance has its place? In aspiration. When you open up, put no limits on it. 101%. Mundaka Upanishad then, talking about the seven rays of the sun lead the aspirant to one world in form of the Lord. Sometimes it's translated as the one Lord world, but it's a realm where the Lord is of a oneness. Where is that? It's at the convergence, the double convergence of the seven rays.